over the long term, so too is the desire to connect with and help others. My guess is that if you take a moment to reflect on the times in your life when you've really been at your best, when you've risen to the challenges before you, finding strength to do what might have seemed impossible, you'll realize that the goals you achieved were connected in some way, shape, or form to the benefit of other people. In sum, there may be gritty villains in the world, but my research suggests there are many more gritty heroes. Fortunate indeed are those who have a top-level goal so consequential to the world that it imbues everything they do, no matter how small or tedious, with significance. Consider the parable of the bricklayers. Three bricklayers are asked, "What are you doing?" The first says, "I am laying bricks." The second says, "I am building a church." And the third says, "I am building the house of God." The first bricklayer has a job. The second has a career. The third has a calling. Many of us would like to be like the third bricklayer, but instead identify with the first or second. Yale management professor Amy Rosneski has found that people have no trouble at all telling her which of the three bricklayers they identify with. In about equal numbers, workers identify themselves as having a job. I view my job as just a necessity of life, much like breathing or sleeping. A career. I view my job primarily as a stepping stone to other jobs. Or a calling. My work is one of the most important things in my life. Using Amy's measures, I too have found that only a minority of workers consider their occupations a calling. Not surprisingly, those who do are significantly grittier than those who feel that job or career more aptly describes their work. Those fortunate people who do see their work as a calling, as opposed to a job or a career, reliably say, "My work makes the world a better place." And it's these people who seem most satisfied with their jobs and their lives overall. In one study, adults who felt their work was a calling missed at least a third fewer days of work than those with a job or a career. Likewise, a recent survey of 982 zookeepers, who belong to a profession in which 80% of workers have college degrees and yet, on average, earn a salary of $25,000, found that those who identified their work as a calling, "Working with animals feels like my calling in life," also expressed a deep sense of purpose. "The work that I do makes the world a better place." Zookeepers with a calling were also more willing to sacrifice unpaid time, after hours, to care for sick animals. And it was zookeepers with a calling who expressed a sense of moral duty. "I have a moral obligation to give my animals the best possible care." I'll point out the obvious. There's nothing wrong with having no professional ambition other than to make an honest living. But most of us yearn for much more. This was the conclusion of journalist Studs Terkel, who in the 1970s interviewed more than 100 working adults in all sorts of professions. Not surprisingly, Terkel found that only a small minority of workers identified their work as a calling. But it wasn't for lack of wanting. All of us, Terkel concluded, are looking for daily meaning as well as daily bread, for a sort of life rather than a Monday through Friday sort of dying. The despair of spending the majority of our waking hours doing something that lacks purpose is vividly embodied in the story of Nora Watson, a 28-year-old staff writer for an institution publishing healthcare information. "Most of us are looking for a calling, not a job," she told Terkel. "There's nothing I would enjoy more than a job that was so meaningful to me that I brought it home." And yet, she admitted to doing about 2 hours of real work a day and spending the rest of the time pretending to work. "I am the only person in the whole damn building with a desk facing the window instead of the door. I just turn myself around from all that I can. I don't think I have a calling at this moment, except to be me," Nora said toward the end of her interview. but nobody pays you for being you, so I'm at the institution for the moment. In the course of his research, Turkle did meet a happy few who find a savor in their daily job. From an outsider's point of view, those with a calling didn't always labor in professions more conducive to purpose than Nora. One was a stonemason, another a bookbinder. A 58-year-old garbage collector named Roy Schmidt told Turkle that his job was exhausting, dirty, and dangerous. He knew most other occupations, including his previous office job, would be considered more attractive to most people. And yet, he said, I don't look down on my job in any way. It's meaningful to society. Contrast Nora's closing words with the ending of Roy's interview. I was told a story one time by a doctor. Years ago in France, if you didn't stand in favor with the king, they'd give you the lowest job, cleaning the streets of Paris, which must have been a mess in those days. One lord goofed up somewhere along the line, so they put him in charge of it. And he did such a wonderful job that he was commended for it. The worst job in the French kingdom, and he was patted on the back for what he did. That was the first time I ever heard about garbage, where it really meant something. In the parable of the bricklayers, everyone has the same occupation, but their subjective experience, how they themselves viewed their work, couldn't be more different. Likewise, Amy's research suggests that callings have little to do with formal job descriptions. In fact, she believes that just about any occupation can be a job, career, or calling. For instance, when she studied secretaries, she initially expected very few to identify their work as a calling. When her data came back, she found that secretaries identified themselves as having a job, career, or calling in equal numbers, just about the same proportion she'd identified in other samples. Amy's conclusion is that it's not that some kinds of occupations are necessarily jobs, and others are careers, and still others are callings. Instead, what matters is whether the person doing the work believes that laying down the next brick is just something that has to be done, or instead, something that will lead to further personal success, or, finally, work that connects the individual to something far greater than the self. I agree. How you see your work is more important than your job title. And this means that you can go from job to career to calling, all without changing your occupation. What do you tell people, I recently asked Amy, when they ask you for advice? A lot of people assume that what they need to do is find their calling, she said. I think a lot of anxiety comes from the assumption that your calling is like a magical entity that exists in the world, waiting to be discovered. That's also how people mistakenly think about interests, I pointed out. They don't realize they need to play an active role in developing and deepening their interests. A calling is not some fully formed thing that you find, Amy tells advice seekers. It's much more dynamic. Whatever you do, whether you're a janitor or the CEO, you can continually look at what you do and ask how it connects to other people, how it connects to the bigger picture, how it can be an expression of your deepest values. In other words, a bricklayer who one day says, "I am laying bricks," might at some point become the bricklayer who recognizes, I am building the house of God. Amy's observation that the same individual in the same occupation can at different times think of it as a job, career, or calling brought to mind Joe Leader. Joe is a senior vice president at New York City Transit. Basically, he's the New York City subway's lead engineer. It's a task of almost unimaginable proportions. Annually, more than 1.7 billion trips are taken on the city's subways, making it the busiest subway system in the United States. There are 469 stations. Laid end to end, the tracks for the subway system would reach all the way to Chicago. As a young man, Leader wasn't looking for a calling. He was looking to pay back student loans. When I was coming out of college, he told me, my biggest concern was just getting a job, any job. Transit came to our campus to recruit engineers, and I got hired. As an intern, Leader was assigned to work on the tracks. I threw in rails, I was pulling ties, I was doing cable work for the third rail. Not everyone would find that work interesting, but Joe did. It was fun. When I was first on the job and all my buddies were business or computer guys, we used to go out, and on the way home from the bars in the evening, they used to run up and down a platform and say, Joe, what's this? What's this? I used to tell them, that's a third rail insulator. That's an insulated joint. To me, it was fun. So, interest was the seed of his passion. Joe soon ended up doing a lot of planning work, which he also enjoyed. As his interests and expertise deepened, he started to distinguish himself, and he began to see transit engineering as a long-term career. On my days off, I went down to the laundromat to do the laundry. You know, those big tables for folding your clothes? Well, all the women used to laugh because I'd bring my engineering drawings and lay them out and work on them. I really fell in love with that part of the job. Within a year, Joe said he began to look at his work differently. Sometimes, he'd look at a bolt or rivet and realize that some fellow had put that in decades ago, and here it was, still in the same place, still making the trains run, still helping people to get where they needed to be. I began to feel like I was making a contribution to society, he told me. I understood I was responsible for moving people every single day. And when I became a project manager, I would walk away from these big installation jobs, you know, 100 panels or a whole interlocking of signals, and I knew that what we'd done was going to last for 30 years. That was when I felt I had a vocation, or I would say, a calling. To hear Joe Leader talk about his work might make you wonder if after a year of not finding your work to be a calling, you should give up hope. Among her MBA students, Amy Rosneski finds that many give their job only a couple of years before concluding that it couldn't possibly be their life's passion. It may comfort you to know that it took Michael Boehm much longer. Michael is a professor of internal medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. You might think his calling is to heal and to teach. That's only partly right. Michael's passion is well-being through mindfulness. It took him years to integrate his personal interest in mindfulness with the other-centered purpose of helping people lead healthier, happier lives. Only when interest and purpose melded did he feel like he was doing what he'd been put on this planet to do. I asked Michael how he got interested in mindfulness, and he took me all the way back to his boyhood. I was looking up at the sky, he told me, and the strangest thing happened. I felt like I was actually getting lost in the sky. I felt it as a sort of opening, like I was becoming much larger. It was the most wonderful experience I've ever had. Later, Michael found that he could make the same thing happen just by paying attention to his own thoughts. I became obsessed, he told me. I didn't know what to call it, but I would do it all the time. Several years later, Michael was browsing in a bookstore with his mother when he came upon a book that described his experience exactly. The book was by Alan Watts, a British philosopher who wrote about meditation for Western audiences long before it became fashionable. With his parents' encouragement, Michael took classes in meditation throughout high school and college. As graduation approached, he had to decide what to do next. Professional meditator was not an actual full-time occupation, so he decided to become a doctor. Several years into medical school, Michael confessed to one of his meditation teachers, "This isn't really what I want to do. This isn't right for me." Medicine was important, but it didn't match up with his deepest personal interests. "Stay," said the teacher. "You'll help more people if you become a doctor." Michael stayed. After finishing his coursework, Michael says, "I didn't really know what I wanted to do. To kind of tread water, I just signed up for the first year of internship." To his surprise, he enjoyed practicing medicine. It was a fine way to be helpful to people. It wasn't like medical school, which isn't so much about helping people as cutting apart cadavers and memorizing the Krebs cycle, Michael told me. Rapidly, he progressed from intern to fellow to running the medical clinic to becoming the assistant director of residency and finally chief of general internal medicine. Still, medicine wasn't quite what Michael would consider a calling. As I practiced, I realized that the thing many of my patients really needed wasn't another prescription or x-ray, but actually what I'd been doing for myself since I was a kid. What many patients needed was to stop and breathe and fully connect with their lived experience. That realization led Michael to create a meditation class for patients with serious health conditions. That was in 1992. Since then, he's expanded the program, and just this year, taking it on as a full-time occupation. To date, about 15,000 patients, nurses, and physicians have been trained. Recently, I asked Michael to give a lecture on mindfulness for local school teachers. On the day of his talk, he stepped up to the podium and looked intently at his audience. One by one, he made eye contact with each of the 70 educators who'd given up their Sunday afternoon to hear what he had to say. There was a long pause. And then, with a smile I can only describe as radiant, he began, "I have a calling." I was 21 when I first experienced the power of a purposeful, top-level goal. In the spring of my junior year in college, I went to the Career Services Center to find something to do that summer. Turning the pages of an enormous 3-ring binder labeled Summer Public Service, I came across a program called SummerBridge. The program was looking for college students to design and teach summer enrichment classes for middle school students from disadvantaged backgrounds. Teaching kids for a summer sounds like a good idea, I thought. I could teach biology and ecology. I'll show them how to make a solar oven out of tinfoil and cardboard. We'll roast hot dogs. It'll be fun. I didn't think, this experience is going to change everything. I didn't think, sure, you're pre-med now, but not for long. I didn't think, hold on tight, you're about to discover the power of purpose. To be honest, I can't tell you much about that summer. The details escape me. I do know I woke long before dawn each day, including weekends, to prepare for my classes. I do know I worked long into the night. I remember specific kids and certain moments, but it wasn't until I returned home and had a moment to reflect that I realized what had happened. I'd glimpsed the possibility that a child's connection with a teacher can be life-changing for both. When I returned to campus that fall, I sought out other students who'd taught at SummerBridge programs. One of these students, Philip King, happened to live in the same dorm. Like me, he felt a palpable urgency to start another SummerBridge program. The idea was too compelling. We couldn't not try. We had no money, no idea how to start a nonprofit, no connections, and in my case, nothing but skepticism and worry from parents convinced this was a catastrophically stupid way to use a Harvard education. Philip and I had nothing, and yet we had exactly what we needed. We had purpose. As anyone who has started an organization from scratch can tell you, there are a million tasks, big and small, and no instruction manual for any of them. If Philip and I were doing something that was merely interesting, we couldn't have done it at all. But because creating this program was in our minds and in our hearts, so overwhelmingly important for kids, it gave us a courage and energy neither of us had ever known before. Because we weren't asking for ourselves, Philip and I found the gumption to knock on the doors of just about every small business and restaurant in Cambridge, asking for donations. We found the patience to sit in countless waiting rooms of powers that be. We waited and waited, sometimes hours on end, until these authority figures had time to see us. Then we found the stubbornness to keep asking and asking until we secured what we needed. And so it went, for everything we had to do, because we weren't doing it for ourselves. We were doing it for a greater cause. 2 weeks after Philip and I graduated, we opened the doors to the program. That summer, 7 high school and college students discovered what it was like to be a teacher. 30 fifth grade boys and girls discovered what it was like to spend their summer vacation learning, studying, working hard, and though it may have seemed impossible before they actually did it, having fun at the same time. That was more than 20 years ago. Now called Breakthrough Greater Boston, the program has grown far beyond what Philip and I could have imagined, providing tuition-free, year-round academic enrichment for hundreds of students every year. To date, more than 1,000 young men and women have taught in the program, many of whom have gone on to pursue full-time careers in education. Summerbridge led me to pursue teaching. Teaching led me to an enduring interest in helping children do so much more with their lives than they might ever dream possible. And yet, for me, teaching wasn't enough. Still unfulfilled was the little girl in me who loved science, who was fascinated by human nature, who when she was 16 and had a chance to take a summer enrichment class, picked of all the courses in the catalog, psychology. Writing this book made me realize that I'm someone who had an inkling about my interests in adolescence, then some clarity about purpose in my 20s, and finally in my 30s, the experience and expertise to say that my top-level, life-organizing goal is and will be, until my last breath, use psychological science to help kids thrive. One reason my dad was so upset about Summerbridge is that he loves me. He thought I would sacrifice my welfare for the well-being of other people, who frankly he didn't love as much as his own daughter. Indeed, the concepts of grit and purpose might in principle seem to conflict. How is it possible to stay narrowly focused on your own top-level goal while also having the peripheral vision to worry about anyone else? If grit is about having a pyramid of goals that all serve a single personal objective, how do other people fit into the picture? Most people think self-oriented and other-oriented motivations are opposite ends of a continuum, says my colleague and Wharton professor Adam Grant. Yet I've consistently found that they're completely independent. You can have neither, and you can have both. In other words, you can want to be a top dog and at the same time be driven to help others. Adam's research demonstrates that leaders and employees who keep both personal and pro-social interests in mind do better in the long run than those who are 100% selfishly motivated. For instance, Adam once asked municipal firefighters, "Why are you motivated to do your work?" He then tracked their overtime hours over the next 2 months, expecting firefighters who were more motivated to help others to demonstrate the greatest grit. But many of those who were driven to help others worked fewer overtime hours. Why? A second motivation was missing, interest in the work itself. Only when they enjoyed the work did the desire to help others result in more effort. In fact, firefighters who expressed pro-social motives, for example, because I want to help others through my work, and intrinsic interest in their work, for example, because I enjoy it, averaged more than 50% more overtime per week than others. When Adam asked the same question, "Why are you motivated to do your work?" of 140 fundraisers at a call center for a public university, he found nearly identical results. Only the fundraisers who expressed stronger pro-social motives and who found the work intrinsically engaging made more calls and in turn raised more money for the university. Developmental psychologists David Yeager and Matt Bundick find the same pattern of results in adolescents. For example, in one study, David interviewed about 100 adolescents, asking them to tell him, in their own words, what they wanted to be when they grew up and why. Some talked about their future in purely self-oriented terms. I want to be a fashion designer because it's a fun thing to do. What's important is that you really enjoy your career. Others only mentioned other oriented motives. I want to be a doctor. I want to help people out. And finally, some adolescents mentioned both self and other oriented motives. If I was a marine biologist, I would push to keep everything clean. I would pick a certain place and go help that place out, like the fish and everything. I've always loved having fish tanks and fish because they get to swim, and it's like free. It's like flying underwater or something. 2 years later, young people who'd mentioned both self and other oriented motives rated their schoolwork as more personally meaningful than classmates who'd named either motive alone. For many of the grit paragons I've interviewed, the road to a purposeful, interesting passion was unpredictable. Aurora and Franco Fonte are Australian entrepreneurs whose facilities services company has 2,500 employees and generates more than $130 million in annual revenue. 27 years ago, Aurora and Franco were newly married and dead broke. They got the idea to start a restaurant, but didn't have enough money to launch one. Instead, they began cleaning shopping malls and small office buildings, not out of any sense of calling, but because it paid the bills. Soon enough, their career ambitions took a turn. They could see a brighter future in building maintenance than in hospitality. They both worked ferociously hard, putting in 80-hour weeks, sometimes with their infant children in carriers strapped across their chests, scrubbing the bathroom tiles in their customers' buildings as if they were their own. Through all the ups and downs, and there were many, Franco told me, "We always persevered. We didn't give in to obstacles. There was no way we were going to let ourselves fail." I confessed to Aurora and Franco that it was hard for me to imagine how cleaning bathrooms, or even building a multi-million dollar corporation that cleans bathrooms, could feel like a calling. "It's not about the cleaning," Aurora explained, her voice tightening with emotion. "It's about building something. It's about our clients and solving their problems. Most of all, it's about the incredible people we employ. They have the biggest souls, and we feel a huge responsibility toward them." According to Stanford developmental psychologist Bill Damon, such a beyond-the-self orientation can and should be deliberately cultivated. Now in the fifth decade of his distinguished career, Bill studies how adolescents learn to lead lives that are personally gratifying and at the same time beneficial to the larger community. The study of purpose, he says, is his calling. In Bill's words, purpose is a final answer to the question, why? Why are you doing this? What has Bill learned about the origins of purpose? "In data set after data set," he told me, "there's a pattern. Everyone has a spark. And that's the very beginning of purpose. That spark is something you're interested in. Next, you need to observe someone who is purposeful. The purposeful role model could be a family member, a historical figure, a political figure. It doesn't really matter who it is, and it doesn't even matter whether that purpose is related to what the child will end up doing. What matters," Bill explained, "is that someone demonstrates that it's possible to accomplish something on behalf of others." In fact, he can't remember a single case in which the development of purpose unfolded without the earlier observation of a purposeful role model. "Ideally," he said, "the child really gets to see how difficult a life of purpose is, all the frustrations and the obstacles, but also how gratifying, ultimately, it can be." What follows is a revelation, as Bill put it. The person discovers a problem in the world that needs solving. This discovery can come in many ways, sometimes from personal loss or adversity, sometimes from learning about the loss and adversity confronting others. "But seeing that someone needs our help isn't enough," Bill hastened to add. "Purpose requires a second revelation. I personally can make a difference. This conviction, this intention to take action," he says, "is why it's so important to have observed a role model enact purpose in their own life. You have to believe that your efforts will not be in vain. Kat Cole is someone who had a role model for purpose-driven grit. I met Kat when she was the 35-year-old president of the Cinnabon bakery chain. If you listen to her story without reflecting much on it, you might dub it rags to riches. But if you lean in and pay attention, you'll hear a different theme, from poverty to purpose. Kat grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. Her mother, Jo, worked up the courage to leave Kat's alcoholic father when Kat was 9. Jo worked 3 jobs to make enough money to support Kat and her 2 sisters, and yet still found time to be a giver. She'd be baking for someone, Kat told me, running an errand for someone. She intuitively saw every small opportunity to do something for others. Everyone she got to know, whether they were coworkers or just people in the community, became family to her. Kat emulated both her mother's work ethic and her profound desire to be helpful. Before we get to Kat's motivation, though, let's consider her unlikely ascent up the corporate ladder. Kat's resume begins with a stint at age 15 selling clothes at the local mall. At 18, she was old enough to waitress. She got a job as a Hooters girl, and 1 year later was asked to help open the first Hooters restaurant in Australia. Ditto for Mexico City, the Bahamas, and then Argentina. By 22, she was running a department of 10. By 26, she was vice president. As a member of the executive team, Kat helped expand the Hooters franchise to more than 400 sites in 28 countries. When the company was bought by a private equity firm, Kat, at age 32, had such an impressive track record that Cinnabon recruited her to be its president. Under Kat's watch, Cinnabon's sales grew faster than they had in more than a decade, and within 4 years exceeded $1 billion. Now, let's consider what makes Kat tick. One time early in Kat's waitressing days at Hooters, the cooks quit in the middle of their shift. So, she told me, matter-of-factly, I went back with the manager and helped cook the food so all the tables got served. Why? First of all, I was surviving off tips. That's how I paid my bills. If people didn't get their food, they wouldn't pay their check, and they certainly wouldn't leave a tip. Second, I was so curious to see if I could do it. And third, I wanted to be helpful. Tips and curiosity are pretty self-oriented motivations, but wanting to be helpful is quite literally other-oriented. Here was an example of how a single action, jumping behind the stove to make food for all those waiting customers, benefited the individual and the people around her. The next thing Kat knew, she was training kitchen employees and helping out with the back office operations. Then one day, she says, the bartender needed to leave early, and the same thing happened. Another day, the manager quit, and I learned how to run a shift. In the course of 6 months, I'd worked every job in the building. Not only did I work those jobs, I became the trainer to help teach all those roles to other people. Jumping into the breach and being especially helpful wasn't a calculated move to get ahead in the corporation. Nevertheless, that beyond the call of duty performance led to an invitation to help open international locations, which led to a corporate executive position, and so on. Not so coincidentally, it's the sort of thing her mother Jo would have done. My passion is to help people, Jo told me, no matter at business or away from business. If you need somebody to come over and build something or help out in some way, I'm that person who wants to be there for you. To me, any success I've had, it's because I love to share. There's no reserve in me. Whatever I have, I'm willing to give it to you or anyone else. Kat attributes her philosophy to her mother, who raised her to work hard and give back, and that ethic still guides her today. Gradually, she told me, I became more and more aware that I was very good at going into new environments and helping people realize they're capable of more than they know. I was discovering that this was my thing, and I started to realize that if I could help people, individuals, do that, then I could help teams. If I could help teams, I could help companies. If I could help companies, I could help brands. If I could help brands, I could help communities and countries. Not long ago, Kat posted an essay on her blog titled, See What's Possible and Help Others Do the Same. When I am around people, Kat wrote, My heart and soul radiate with the awareness that I'm in the presence of greatness. Maybe greatness unfound or greatness underdeveloped, but the potential or existence of greatness nevertheless. You never know who will go on to do good or even great things or become the next great influencer in the world, so treat everyone like they are that person. Whatever your age, it's never too early or late to begin cultivating a sense of purpose. I have three recommendations, each borrowed from one of the purpose researchers mentioned in this chapter. David Yeager recommends reflecting on how the work you're already doing can make a positive contribution to society. In several longitudinal experiments, David Yeager and his colleague Dave Palnescu asked high school students, how could the world be a better place? And then asked them to draw connections to what they were learning in school. In response, one ninth grader wrote, I would like to get a job as some sort of genetic researcher. I would use this job to help improve the world by possibly engineering crops to produce more food. Another said, I think that having an education allows you to understand the world around you. I will not be able to help anyone without first going to school. This simple exercise, which took less than a class period to complete, dramatically energized student engagement. Compared to a placebo control exercise, reflecting on purpose led students to double the amount of time they spent studying for an upcoming exam, work harder on tedious math problems when given the option to watch entertaining videos instead, and in math and science classes, bring home better report card grades. Amy Rusnitsky recommends thinking about how, in small but meaningful ways, you can change your current work to enhance its connection to your core values. Amy calls this idea job crafting, and it's an intervention she's been studying with fellow psychologists Jane Dutton, Justin Berg, and Adam Grant. This is not a Pollyanna, every job can be nirvana idea. It is simply the notion that whatever your occupation, you can maneuver within your job description, adding, delegating, and customizing what you do to match your interests and values. Amy and her collaborators recently tested this idea at Google. Employees working in positions that don't immediately bring the word purpose to mind, in sales, marketing, finance, operations, and accounting, for example, were randomly assigned to a job crafting workshop. They came up with their own ideas for tweaking their daily routines, each employee making a personalized map for what would constitute more meaningful and enjoyable work. 6 weeks later, managers and coworkers rated the employees who attended this workshop as significantly happier and more effective. Finally, Bill Damon recommends finding inspiration in a purposeful role model. He'd like you to respond in writing to some of the questions he uses in his interview research, including, imagine yourself 15 years from now. What do you think will be most important to you then? And, can you think of someone whose life inspires you to be a better person? Who? Why? When I carried out Bill's exercise, I realized that the person in my life, who more than anyone has shown me the beauty of other-centered purpose, is my mom. She is, without exaggeration, the kindest person I've ever met. Growing up, I didn't always appreciate mom's generous spirit. I resented the strangers who shared our table every Thanksgiving. Not just distant relatives who'd recently emigrated from China, but their roommates and their roommates' friends. Pretty much anyone who didn't have a place to go who happened to run into my mom in the month of November was warmly welcomed into our home. One year, mom gave away my birthday presents a month after I'd unwrapped them, and another, she gave away my sister's entire stuffed animal collection. We threw tantrums and wept and accused her of not loving us. But there are children who need them more, she said, genuinely surprised at our reaction. You have so much. They have so little. When I told my father I wouldn't be taking the MCAT exam for medical school and instead would devote myself to creating the Summer Bridge program, he was apoplectic. Why do you care about poor kids? They're not family. You don't even know them. I now realize why. All my life, I'd seen what one person, my mother, could do to help many others. I'd witnessed the power of purpose. Chapter 9, Hope. There's an old Japanese saying, fall 7, rise 8. If I were ever to get a tattoo, I'd get these four simple words indelibly inked. What is hope? One kind of hope is the expectation that tomorrow will be better than today. It's the kind of hope that has us yearning for sunnier weather or a smoother path ahead. It comes without the burden of responsibility. The onus is on the universe to make things better. Grit depends on a different kind of hope. It rests on the expectation that our own efforts can improve our future. I have a feeling tomorrow will be better is different from I resolve to make tomorrow better. The hope that gritty people have has nothing to do with luck and everything to do with getting up again. In the spring of my first year of college, I enrolled in neurobiology. I would come to each class early and sit in the front row, where I'd copy every equation and diagram into my notebook. Outside of lecture, I did all the assigned readings and required problem sets. Going into the first quiz, I was a little shaky in a few areas. It was a tough course, and my high school biology coursework left a lot to be desired. But on the whole, I felt pretty confident. The quiz started out fine, but quickly became more difficult. I began to panic, thinking over and over again, I'm not going to finish. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm going to fail. This, of course, was a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more my mind was crowded by those heart-palpitating thoughts, the less I could concentrate. Time ran out before I'd even read the last problem. A few days later, the professor handed back the quiz. I looked down disconsolately at my miserable grade, and shortly thereafter shuffled into the office of my assigned teaching assistant. You should really consider dropping this course, he advised. You're just a freshman. You have 3 more years. You can always take the class later. I took AP Bio in high school, I countered. How did you do? I got an A, but my teacher didn't teach us much, which is probably why I didn't take the actual AP exam. This confirmed his intuition that I should drop the course. Virtually the same scenario repeated itself with the midterm, for which I'd studied madly, and after which I found myself in the teaching assistant's office once again. This time his tone was more urgent. You do not want a failing grade on your transcript. It's not too late to withdraw from the course. If you do, nothing will get factored into your GPA. I thanked him for his time and closed the door behind me. In the hallway, I surprised myself by not crying. Instead, I reviewed the facts of the situation. 2 failures and only 1 more exam, the final, before the end of the semester. I realized I should have started out in a lower level course, and now, more than halfway through the semester, it was obvious my energetic studying wasn't proving sufficient. If I stayed, there was a good chance I'd choke on the final and end up with an F on my transcript. If I dropped the course, I'd cut my losses. I curled my hands into fists, clenched my jaw, and marched directly to the registrar's office. At that moment, I'd resolved to stay enrolled in, and in fact, major in, neurobiology. Looking back on that pivotal day, I can see that I'd been knocked down, or more accurately, tripped on my own 2 feet, and fell flat on my face. Regardless, it was a moment when I could have stayed down. I could have said to myself, I'm an idiot, nothing I do is good enough, and I could have dropped the class. Instead, my self-talk was defiantly hopeful. I won't quit. I can figure this out. For the rest of the semester, I not only tried harder, I tried things I hadn't done before. I went to every teaching assistant's office hours. I asked for extra work. I practiced doing the most difficult problems under time pressure, mimicking the conditions under which I needed to produce a flawless performance. I knew my nerves were going to be a problem at exam time, so I resolved to attain a level of mastery where nothing could surprise me. By the time the final exam came around, I felt like I could have written it myself. I aced the final. My overall grade in the course was a B, the lowest grade I'd get in 4 years, but ultimately the one that made me the proudest. Little did I know when I was floundering in my neurobiology class that I was recreating the conditions of a famous psychology experiment. Let me wind back the clock to 1964. Two first-year psychology doctoral students named Marty Seligman and Steve Mayer are in a windowless laboratory watching a caged dog receive electric shocks to its back paws. The shocks come randomly and without warning. If the dog does nothing, the shock lasts 5 seconds. But if the dog pushes its nose against a panel at the front of the cage, the shock ends early. In a separate cage, another dog is receiving the same shocks at exactly the same intervals, but there's no panel to push on. In other words, both dogs get the exact same dosage of shock at the exact same times, but only the first dog is in control of how long each shock lasts. After 64 shocks, both dogs go back to their home cages, and new dogs are brought in for the same procedure. The next day, one by one, all the dogs are placed in a different cage called a shuttle box. In the middle, there's a low wall, just high enough that the dogs can leap the barrier if they try. A high-pitched tone plays, heralding an impending shock, which comes through the floor of the half of the shuttle box where the dog is standing. Nearly all the dogs who had control over the shocks the previous day learn to leap the barrier. They hear the tone and jump over the wall to safety. In contrast, 2/3 of the dogs who had no control over the shocks the previous day just lie down whimpering, passively waiting for the punishments to stop. This seminal experiment proved for the first time that it isn't suffering that leads to hopelessness. It's suffering you think you can't control. Many years after deciding to major in the subject I was failing, I sat in a graduate student cubicle a few doors down from Marty's office, reading about this experiment on learned helplessness. I quickly saw the parallels to my earlier experience. The first neurobiology quiz brought unexpected pain. I struggled to improve my situation, but when the midterm came, I got shocked again. The shuttle box was the rest of the semester. Would I conclude from my earlier experience that I was helpless to change my situation? After all, my immediate experience suggested that two disastrous outcomes would be followed by a third. Or would I be like the few dogs who, despite recent memories of uncontrollable pain, held fast to hope? Would I consider my earlier suffering to be the result of particular mistakes I could avoid in the future? Would I expand my focus beyond the recent past, remembering the many times I'd shrugged off failure and eventually prevailed? As it turns out, I behaved like the 1/3 of dogs in Marty and Steve's study that persevered. I got up again and kept fighting. In the decade following that 1964 experiment, additional experiments revealed that suffering without control reliably produces symptoms of clinical depression, including changes in appetite and physical activity, sleep problems, and poor concentration. When Marty and Steve first proposed that animals and people can learn that they are helpless, their theory was considered downright absurd by fellow researchers. Nobody at the time took seriously the possibility that dogs could have thoughts that then influenced their behavior. In fact, few psychologists entertained the possibility that people had thoughts that influenced their behavior. Instead, the received wisdom was that all living animals simply respond mechanically to punishments and rewards. After a mountain of data had accumulated, ruling out every conceivable alternative explanation, the scientific community was at long last convinced. Having thoroughly plumbed the disastrous consequences of uncontrollable stress in the laboratory, Marty grew more and more interested in what could be done about it. He decided to retrain as a clinical psychologist. Wisely, he chose to do so under the wing of Aaron Beck, a psychiatrist and fellow pioneer in understanding the root causes and practical antidotes for depression. What followed was a vigorous exploration of the flip side of learned helplessness, which Marty later dubbed learned optimism. The crucial insight that seeded Marty's new work was available from the very beginning. While 2/3 of the dogs that had experienced uncontrollable shock later gave up trying to help themselves, About a third remained resilient. Despite their earlier trauma, they kept trying maneuvers that would bring relief from pain. It was those resilient dogs that led Marty to study the analogous "I won't quit" response to adversity in people. Optimists, Marty soon discovered, are just as likely to encounter bad events as pessimists. Where they diverge is in their explanations. Optimists habitually search for temporary and specific causes of their suffering, whereas pessimists assume permanent and pervasive causes are to blame. Here's an example from the test Marty and his students developed to distinguish optimists from pessimists. Imagine you can't get all the work done that others expect of you. Now imagine one major cause for this event. What leaps to mind? After you read that hypothetical scenario, you write down your response. And then, after you're offered more scenarios, your responses are rated for how temporary versus permanent and how specific versus pervasive they are. If you're a pessimist, you might say, "I screw up everything," or "I'm a loser." These explanations are all permanent. There's not much you can do to change them. They're also pervasive. They're likely to influence lots of life situations, not just your job performance. Permanent and pervasive explanations for adversity turn minor complications into major catastrophes. They make it seem logical to give up. If, on the other hand, you're an optimist, you might say, "I mismanaged my time," or "I didn't work efficiently because of distractions." These explanations are all temporary and specific. Their fixability motivates you to start clearing them away as problems. Using this test, Marty confirmed that, compared to optimists, pessimists are more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety. What's more, optimists fare better in domains not directly related to mental health. For instance, optimistic undergraduates tend to earn higher grades and are less likely to drop out of school. Optimistic young adults stay healthier throughout middle age and ultimately live longer than pessimists. Optimists are more satisfied with their marriages. A 1-year field study of MetLife insurance agents found that optimists are twice as likely to stay in their jobs, and they sell about 25% more insurance than their pessimistic colleagues. Likewise, studies of salespeople in telecommunications, real estate, office products, car sales, banking, and other industries have shown that optimists outsell pessimists by 20 to 40%. In one study, elite swimmers, many of whom were training for the U.S. Olympic trials, took Marty's optimism test. Next, coaches asked each swimmer to swim in his or her best event and then deliberately told each swimmer they'd swum just a little slower than was actually the case. Given the opportunity to repeat their event, optimists did at least as well as in their first attempt, but pessimists performed substantially worse. How do grit paragons think about setbacks? Overwhelmingly, I found that they explain events optimistically. Journalist Hester Lacey finds the same striking pattern in her interviews with remarkably creative people. "What has been your greatest disappointment?" she asks each of them. Whether they're artists or entrepreneurs or community activists, their response is nearly identical. "Well, I don't really think in terms of disappointment. I tend to think that everything that happens is something I can learn from. I tend to think, well, okay, that didn't go so well, but I guess I will just carry on." Around the time Marty Seligman took his 2-year hiatus from laboratory research, his new mentor, Aaron Beck, was questioning his own training in Freudian psychoanalysis. Like most psychiatrists at the time, Beck had been taught that all forms of mental illness were rooted in unconscious childhood conflicts. Beck disagreed. He had the audacity to suggest that a psychiatrist could actually talk directly to patients about what was bothering them, and that the patient's thoughts, their self-talk, could be the target of therapy. The foundational insight of Beck's new approach was that the same objective event, losing a job, getting into an argument with a coworker, forgetting to call a friend, can lead to very different subjective interpretations. And it is those interpretations, rather than the objective events themselves, that can give rise to our feelings and our behavior. Cognitive behavioral therapy, which aims to treat depression and other psychological maladies by helping patients think more objectively and behave in healthier ways, has shown that whatever our childhood sufferings, we can generally learn to observe our negative self-talk and change our maladaptive behaviors. As with any other skill, we can practice interpreting what happens to us and responding as an optimist would. Cognitive behavioral therapy is now a widely practiced psychotherapeutic treatment for depression and has proven longer lasting in its effects than antidepressant medication. A few years after I'd gotten a toehold in grit research, Wendy Kopp, the founder and then CEO of Teach for America, came to visit Marty. Then still his graduate student, I was eager to join their meeting for two reasons. First, Teach for America was sending hundreds of recent college graduates into disadvantaged school districts across the country. From personal experience, I knew teaching to be a grit-demanding profession, nowhere more so than in the urban and rural classrooms where TFA teachers are assigned. Second, Wendy was herself a paragon of grit. Famously, she'd conceived of TFA during her senior year at Princeton, and unlike so many idealists who eventually give up on their dream, she'd stuck with it, starting from nothing and creating one of the largest and most influential educational nonprofits in the country. Relentless pursuit was both a core value of TFA and a phrase often used by friends and coworkers to describe Wendy's leadership style. At that meeting, the three of us developed a hypothesis. Teachers who have an optimistic way of interpreting adversity have more grit than their more pessimistic counterparts, and grit, in turn, predicts better teaching. For instance, an optimistic teacher might keep looking for ways to help an uncooperative student, whereas a pessimist might assume there was nothing more to be done. To test whether that was true, we decided to measure optimism and grit before teachers set foot in the classroom, and a year later, see how effectively teachers had advanced the academic progress of their students. That August, 400 TFA teachers completed the grit scale, and in addition, Marty's questionnaire assessing their optimism. To the extent they thought of temporary and specific causes for bad events, and permanent and pervasive causes of good events, we coded their responses as optimistic. To the extent they did the reverse, we coded their responses as pessimistic. In the same survey, we measured one more thing, happiness. Why? For one thing, there was a small but growing body of scientific evidence that happiness wasn't just the consequence of performing well at work, it might also be an important cause. Also, we were curious about how happy the grittiest teachers were. Did single-minded passion and perseverance come at a cost? Or could you be gritty and happy at the same time? 1 year later, when Teach for America had tabulated effectiveness ratings for each teacher based on the academic gains of their students, we analyzed our data. Just as we'd expected, optimistic teachers were grittier and happier, and grit and happiness in turn explained why optimistic teachers got their students to achieve more during the school year. After staring at these results for a while, I began reminiscing about my own experience of classroom teaching. I remember the many afternoons I'd gone home exasperated and exhausted. I remembered battling catastrophic self-talk about my own capabilities. Oh God, I really am an idiot. And those of my young charges. She got it wrong again? She'll never learn this. And I remembered the mornings I'd gotten up and decided, after all, that there was one more tactic worth trying. Maybe if I bring in a Hershey bar and cut it into pieces, they'll get the idea of fractions. Maybe if I have everyone clean out their lockers on Mondays, they'll get in the habit of keeping their lockers clean. The data from this study of young teachers, along with Wendy Kopp's intuitions, interviews with grit paragons, and a half century of psychological research, all point to the same common sense conclusion. When you keep searching for ways to change your situation for the better, you stand a chance of finding them. When you stop searching, assuming they can't be found, you guarantee they won't. Or, as Henry Ford is often quoted as saying, whether you think you can